Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We begin today's program in Indonesia. The ABC, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, has had one person in their bureau for 40 years. Sujanta Tadrayanti, as she is known, has been working as the ABC with ABC correspondents for almost 40 years. And today we'd like to bring you her story. Here's Samantha Holy.
I started working with the ABC on 19 February 1979.
How old were you then?
I think 25 years old.
Yeah, so young, youthful, yeah. Very youthful. Were you married by then?
Not yet.
Can you remember how you felt going to work on the first day?
I'm very happy because the office in the center of the city, so easy for me to come to the office.
Tell me about the early years when you were in the office. You had one correspondent. Who was that, and then what happened after that?
We have two correspondents when I start working with the ABC, because we have Radio Australia, and then the other one is ABC News. The correspondent for the Radio Australia is Mr. Alan Morris. And then for the ABC is Mr. Warwick Beutler.
And then there was a big gap for a while, wasn't there, when there wasn't a correspondent here. So what happened? What happened then?
There is no correspondent anymore. Then we work for the Radio Australia Indonesian service. Then because we receive many letters from the listeners, and then we distribute to them for the English lesson.
Mm-hmm. How were Indonesians getting information then? That was during Suharto, and then Suharto had banned Australian journalists from here, which was why there was no correspondence.
So, at that time, the Radio Australia is the most popular of the radio, because the listeners in Indonesia gets the news about the politics, about everything, because last time that with the Suharto regime, there is too hard to get the
information,
yes.
What was it like for you and your family when Suharto was in power over that period?
For us especially, I think there is no problem for us until 1998.
So by then you were married and you had a daughter?
I'm waiting to have a daughter for 8 years.
Oh, you tried for 8 years?
Yes.
It was difficult?
It's very difficult.
You had a daughter after eight years of trying?
8 years.
Wow. What was 1998 like for you and your family?
It's too hard for us, yeah, especially for the Chinese people.
Give me some examples, like what was happening, that, you know, were you scared? What was happening?
We are scared. So many people are living in Indonesia. Like one of the ex-ABC staff, Ibu Hani, left Indonesia on the 20th of November 1998 with all the family.
Where did they
move
go?
To America, mm-hmm. Until now.
How were you sort of trying to protect your own family during that time?
I'm still work with the ABC.
Yeah.
Every day.
Every day, yes.
I went to the office every day.
Yeah.
And then try to save at the house, mm-hmm. because I live not in the Chinese community, no? We are mixed, mm-hmm. so I think it's good.
Safer.
My daughter moved to America on the 2002. She tried to get a better education there, mm-hmm. and then try to get a better future. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it must have been hard for you, though, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still hard, yeah?
Still hard, yes. Mm-hmm. And then she moved to America when she was 14 years old. Yeah.
Tell me about, because I love your CCTV story, because you can...
Every day
you can look.
Take a look.
So your daughter has CCTV at her house,
yes,
right? And every day you go on your mobile phone and you can see her house. So every day.
Yeah. And then some. I try to give her a good study there. Mm-hmm. I'm always, when I get the salary every month, first for her. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of that
for you. Not much for you, I would think. No. She must be very grateful, Yanti.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think life would have been like for her if she stayed in Indonesia?
I don't know, yeah. Mm. But I'm pretty sure that God is give her a better life there.
In the almost 40 years, is there any... moments that stand out for you, you know, in terms of news that had happened or something that happened with the correspondence or, you know, anything like that? You can speak freely yet.
Sam, you are the first correspondent here. The woman correspondent here. And then before you, there is no...
No women.
There is no woman, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the correspondent came and go.
Yeah, and you've had about 10, I think, correspondents.
Yes, 10.
And I can imagine they're quite difficult, quite difficult to deal with most of the time, foreign correspondents. Speak freely, Yanti.
I think all the correspondent is... good. I'm still here.
You're still here. You're still here. Every day.
Every day.
Yeah. And do you still enjoy the job?
Yes.
What do you enjoy most about it?
Enjoy about everything that I have.
Yeah. And you've had some constant, like the Indonesian staff are very good too.
Like my family. And then the ABC is the second home, yeah.
Yanti, as she's known, speaking to Samantha Holly, and she's been working with ABC correspondents in Jakarta for 40 years. Now, Indonesia has had a long history of Australian journalists, even going back to the colonial era. Rosa Tapsell is a lecturer in Asian Studies at the School of Culture, History and Language at the Australian National University. She actually has a very interesting book called Lines, Babo, Bali Bombings, Australian Journalists in Indonesia. She speaks next to Richard Ady about the history of Australian journalists in Indonesia.
It's now feared that 5 Australian television newsmen may have been killed in the fighting in East Timor. The bodies of 4 white men were found in the ruins of a house in Balibo late last week, soon after the newsmen were reported missing. Also near the bodies was a handwritten note with the word Australia on it.
Jim, did any of these journalists have any experience in a war zone?
From what I've been told, none of them had, except Brian Peters, the Channel 9 cameraman, who had been was the first TV cameraman to go into Timor once hostilities began. But all the rest were in their early 20s, and from what I've been told, none of them had ever been in a war zone before.
How much does Balibo cast a shadow over Australian journalists in Indonesia?
Well, I think the interesting... a point about Balibo that comes out in this research is really about what the governments said about Australian journalists' actions post-Balibo and post the deaths of those journalists. And a lot of the government reports and government documents, and even actually from academics, were saying that Australian journalists have had a, quote, a vendetta against Indonesia, and in particular the New Order government in Indonesia, because of the deaths of their colleagues in Balibo, East Timor, 1975. And this came through from successive prime ministers of Australia, government officials from Indonesia, and indeed some academics.
All right, but you talk to a lot of Australian journalists too. How much consciousness did they have that Balibo had happened?
Yeah, obviously the first suspicion was this seems to be a cop-out from government, that it's the government blaming the journalists for the problems in the relationship.
Easy to do.
Easy to do. And, of course, as we've seen since 1975, but also more recently with regard to the spying scandal, the government is very quick to say that the problem is the media and that they're pushing negative stories about each other. And of course, news is negative by its very nature, and often what we hear about Indonesia is negative news. But to say that journalists had a vendetta is a very strong accusation.
What about, though, the wider issue of East Timor? Because it was obviously for years, decades, a story that Australian journalists would want to report, and when they did report, they often fell foul of Indonesian authorities.
Yes, that's right. And what we saw, in fact, in the 1980s was journalists were evicted from Indonesia for reporting critically of East Timor. And, of course, journalists played a really big role in getting information about East Timor out to the rest of the world, Australian journalists in particular. It was heavily censored, of course, by the Indonesian government and military at that time. And really the opening up of East Timor in 1998-1999 by Habibie, the Indonesian president, allowed for international media to come into Timor, which really created a position where people could hear about the atrocities that were going on there. So the important thing is that journalists on the ground had such a big impact in 99, when prior to that, 75 through to 99, under the Indonesian New Order government, journalists were simply not allowed in. And when they were allowed in and they reported on it, they were evicted or accused of being biased.
Mm. Now, how was the reporting of what happened by Australian journalists perceived in Indonesia?
It's a good question. There has been thesis written on this, and often what you'll find is incredibly nationalistic arguments in the media, and we're seeing that very much now with regard to the Bali 9 case, a media that really pushes nationalistic sentiments. And those people who've studied this on the Indonesian media reporting of East Timor in 99 have shown that really this was seen as a betrayal of Australia, and in fact a very big disappointment in Indonesia for the Indonesian nation.
The East Timorese know about pain and now joy.
The United Nations has hailed the vote on East Timor's future as an extraordinary success.
For 24 years, the people of East Timor have struggled against an oppressive regime. Today proved that struggle has not been in vain.
The result was really makes me happy, and I'm stand up, embrace my younger brothers, and I'm embrace them with tears and with happiness.
Now, East Timor's obviously a big part of Australian reporting over the last 35 years, but there have also been these other issues, just as important, I suspect, for Indonesia, and where there's kind of a fracture at the periphery. So Aceh, West Papua, Australian journalists have actually mostly wanted to report on these places and not been able to get there and do it.
That's right. And I looked back at the Jakarta Foreign Correspondents Club in 1969, and they protested saying that a lack of access to Papua would lead to international condemnation of Indonesia's involvement in the region and hindrance to freedoms of the press in that region. So nothing new there, really. This has been going on for a long time. But certainly it's in those periphery regions, the outer regions, Aceh to the far west, and Papua to the far east, which Indonesia has been most sensitive about because of the breakaway movements there.
Ross, this kind of underlines what has been the tension, certainly under the Suharto government. So from the mid-60s till the end of the 90s, that government was intent on establishing stability and nation building in a way. The nature of journalism is the opposite of stability. It's the bad stuff that makes for the good stories. So the journalists would have felt that they had to go looking for the bad stuff.
Yeah, so the Suharto government, the New Order government from 1965, really pushed this idea that journalists had to be free but responsible. And this was the line constantly used as a reason for banning news organisations, including obviously local Indonesian organisations, and as well as evicting foreign correspondents, and which a majority of whom included Australians. Mm. So the idea, free but responsible, and this was needed for nation building, for stability. Indonesia was not, the argument goes, Indonesia is not ready for a complete freedom of the press because it will lead to more riots, more chaos. And in fact, you heard this from Lee Kuan Yew, you heard this from Mahathir, you heard this from many countries in the region, leaders in the region, that a free press needs to be responsible. And of course, defining responsible is where the clash of ideologies came in.
But the Australian journalists were from the tradition that we hold dear in Australia, and we don't always meet ourselves, which is that if something bad's happening, it's a story and we should be able to write about it.
That's right. But what we've seen probably more recently has been journalists coming straight in from Australia, what I've called their parachute journalists. Mm. And there we've got a preconceived story, right? Here's a negative story going on. We've got to get some journalists from Australia in there to report on. So absolutely, as the fourth estate is to comment on and critique the government and its institutions, and that's the nature of Australian and Western media.
There was just a procession of people covered in blood, covered in glass. People's backs had obviously been on fire. It was just horrible.
Tonight, dozens of Australians feared dead after a car bomb tears through a nightclub district in Bali. The death toll is now more than 180.
I was going to ask about issues that really have happened in Bali in the last 15 years. Starting with the Bali bombings, that, it seems, from the sort of outsider's perspective, changed the dynamic, again, of how we reported Indonesia.
Yeah, a couple of interesting points to make. The first is Indonesia became incredibly free for its media since Suharto fell. And what we saw was this real compulsion or this determination in Indonesia that they wanted to have this really free and vibrant press. And of course, it for the most part does. But it included having a more transparent courtroom, which allows for cameras to be played rolling in the courtroom. Now, in Australia, we don't have that, of course. So, of course, the Australian media love the idea of getting to Denpasar and the courtroom there and being able to roll the cameras of Chappelle Corby and the Bali Nine and Michelle Leslie. And Australians lapped it up. So what we saw, I think, on the decision for the Chappelle Corby verdict was about 1.7 million Australians tuning in for the live verdict. That year, about 18% of all foreign news stories came from Indonesia, and most of that was Chappelle Bali courtroom type stories, 2005. So Indonesia suddenly in the news much more than it used to be in the past, Indonesia itself, but it's mostly about what Australians are doing there.
Yeah, and it's come along at the same time that we've had these advances in technology that have really magnified things. So if you go back to Australians reporting from Indonesia from the mid-60s, difficult to file, could probably only do it at certain times of day for broadcast, and you'd only file once.
Right, exactly.
In fact, for the papers. Now it's constant.
That's right. And there's one great story of a Sydney Morning Herald journalist who went to Sulawesi, and he was gone for so long that his news organisation reported him missing, feared dead. These days, a journalist couldn't leave the office for more than 24 hours, I presume, without the editors calling and saying, hey, where's my story? So a lot of the contemporary correspondents, when interviewed, talked about the difficulties, firstly, in getting out of Jakarta, because they're so much more chained to the desk for rolling news stories, you know, constantly reporting for radio, television, online. And secondly, the rise in editorial direction from Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra and so on, which in the past foreign correspondents could largely ignore because communications didn't allow for regular contact.
Do you have a sense on how well served we are as news consumers in Australia by the work of Australian journalists in Indonesia?
Certainly, I think it's just been different over time, and I think that's what this book shows. Mm. When you go back to the 1945 period, what we saw there was that Australians moved to Indonesia because their news organisation said to them, report on another war. That was the direction. So the 1945 generation really saw Indonesia as the War of Independence, as a kind of extension of World War II, and an argument that they had to push to show that Indonesian independence is worth fighting for. So your question there is, well, how well served are we? And a lot of what this book explains is how it changed over time. The 45 period journalists talked about wanting to really support Indonesia's independence. By the 1950s, journalists were talking about explaining Australia's role in the region. And that's how they saw their duty, their service there was to explain that Australia was now part of Asia and the post-colonial attitudes had to go. The 60s journalists became much more professional. So they saw as reporting from the politics in the capital as the key. And so on, 1970s, we talked about Balabo and advocacy journalism and reporting the truth and the deceits of government at that time. And the more contemporary correspondent, of course, much more competitive because of the instantaneous nature of news.
One still feels that there's a great deal of mutual ignorance between Australians more widely, not just journalists, and Indonesians.
Yeah, when you look at some of the surveys, I think most surveys show that very few Australians know that Indonesia is a democracy. There's a significant amount of Australians who travel to Bali and haven't realised that they've actually been in Indonesia. So generally speaking, and this has happened over a long period of time, perceptions of Indonesia are mistaken stereotypes, that Indonesia is still run by the military, that Indonesia is a hotbed of Islamic extremism, and that Indonesia essentially is a kind of haven for terrorists. So these kind of negative perceptions are very much how people see Indonesia, and certainly these Bali 9 situation at the moment doesn't help. Indonesia really only has itself to blame. But also it's about the lack of broadening of the stories of Indonesia in the news.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, which is coming to you from PCJ Radio International, heard around the world on the World Radio Network.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
To end the program, as we always do, we now take a look at propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here is our, well, I would like to call him now our propagation king. Yes, that's his new name, our propagation king, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from Space Weather Services Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through November 11th. Fair at low and middle latitudes, fair to poor at high latitude bands. From Space Weather South Africa through November 11th, magnetic conditions active to minor storm, shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through November 12th, solar activity very low, geomagnetic activity a 20 to 50% chance of further G1 minor storms. From Space Weather Canada, after a DRX peak of 220 nanoteslas November 9th and 10th in the auroral zone, a lesser one is coming November 21st and 22nd, reaching 150. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on November 11th, 14th, and 22nd. Quiet on November 12th, 13th, and 23rd to 27th. Quiet to unsettled on November 15th and 20th. mostly quiet on November 16th to 19th. Active to disturbed on November 21st. From the Space Environment Prediction Center, China, planetary A index dropping from 47 November 8th to 6 by November 12th. Up to 19 on the 21st, back to single digits from the 23rd, and up to 29 on December 4th. Solar flux rising from a low of 67 on November 9th to a peak of 79 on November 23rd. From SWPC in Boulder, Colorado, solar flux creeping up from 70 November 13th to 75 from November 17th to 30th. Minor G1 geomagnetic storm levels lingering through November 11th with A and K indices of 25 and 5. And again November 20th to 22nd up to 20 and 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on November 13th, 14th, 18th, 19th, 23rd to 28th, and December 1st and 2nd.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. Our email address, of course, is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know if you have any story ideas for us, because we'd love to hear from you. Anyway, that's all we have time for. So until next time, friends, 73 and 88 to the ladies.